And welcome back to this week's episode of Until Green Card Do Us Part, a weekly show where we address the issues that immigration-based marriages made a few feet short of heaven create for American citizens and their families. Now, as this show progresses, we're likely to be expanding the issues that we discuss to involve other immigration and visa fraud issues, as well as the whole topic of immigration itself in general. I'm your host, John Sampson, CSI Consulting CEO. Last week, we began to look at the level of corruption and irresponsible conduct on the part of USCIS upper management. We left off discussing fraud issues surrounding the issuance of employment authorization documents, or EADs. And we're going to be picking that up where we left off. But first, a quick recap is in order. Michael J. Maxwell, the former director of the Office of Security and Investigations, or OSI, the USCIS's Internal Affairs Unit, had testified on two occasions in 2006 before Congress after he was forced out from USCIS OSI. He resigned, for those of you who are wondering why, because the powers to be in USCIS, from the director as well as acting deputy director Robert Devine, acting chief counsel Dia Carpenter, Laura Dawkins, Janice Passato, Tom Parr, and Don Crescetti, who was the director of fraud detection and national security, among others, simply didn't want Maxwell to do his job, nor did they want a law enforcement component within USCIS. They viewed then, and USCIS upper management today still views USCIS's role as being akin to a Department of Social Services granting benefits to deserving foreign nationals and not securing the homeland. This mentality changed for a brief time under President Trump and Ken Cuccinelli, who oversaw USCIS during the Trump administration. However, the social worker mindset and mentality has resurfaced with a vengeance within the Biden-Harris administration. So let's pick up with Maxwell's testimony where we left off last week. Maxwell testified before Congress in April of 2006, and his testimony continues. To make this situation worse, information I have just received in the past few days suggests two additional problems with the processing of I-765s, the application form for an EAD, or employment authorization document. First, it appears that the Texas Service Center has developed an auto-adjudication system that can process I-765s from start to finish without any human involvement whatsoever. In other words, there is no point in the process when a USCIS employee actually examines the supporting documentation to look for signs of fraud. Instead, the I-765 application is processed automatically when the underlying application for LPR status has been sitting on the shelf for 90 days. Now, let me put that in its proper perspective. In Denver, Colorado, the average processing time for an I-485 application for adjustment of status to permanent residence takes from 12 to 23 months. They are processing I-485 applications for adjustment of status to permanent residence filed on or before May 1st, 2019 for family-based adjustment applications and processing I-485 applications for adjustment of status filed on or before December 14th, 2016 for employment-based adjustment applications. This means 90 days after an alien files for adjustment of status, they apply for and get an employment authorization document, or EAD, even if they're ineligible to adjust status in the first place. The mere filing of the application and the passage of 90 days is sufficient to see an alien get an EAD or work permit. So with the automatic adjudication of EADs in Dallas, no one even looks to see if the alien who's receiving authorization to be employed in the United States gets the EAD, and from there gets a Social Security number and driver's license that complies with the Real ID Act, even if later on the I-485 application for adjustment of status is denied. Are you beginning to get the picture here? But wait, if you think Denver's bad, you ain't seen nothing yet. The California Service Center in Laguna Niguel has an estimated processing time for I-485s ranging from 43.5 to 63 months. They are adjudicating I-485s filed on or before December 22, 2015. In the Vermont Service Center, where VAWA applications are adjudicated, the estimated processing times for 485s for U and T visas range from 16.5 to 29 months. This is after the U and T visa holder has been a U or T visa holder for 3 or more years. And this data comes directly from USCIS as of today. Maxwell continues. The second issue identified during the same review that uncovered the auto adjudication system is just as troubling. Staff at the National Benefits Center in Lee Summit, Missouri, acknowledged that there is a way to bypass the normal application process and manually insert any number of applications into the computer system so that the standard application screening process is totally circumvented. Independent investigators are currently attempting to determine how many applications have been improperly processed in this way and by whom. Moving on to fingerprint waivers. A memo to regional directors from Michael Pearson, then head of field operations, set out USCIS policy on the granting of waivers of the FBI fingerprint check requirement for aliens who are unable to provide fingerprints because of, among other things, psychological conditions. The policy states the determination regarding the fingerprinting of applicants or petitions who have accessible fingers but on whose behalf a claim is made that they cannot be fingerprinted for psychological reasons, can be far less certain. Unless the ASC manager is certain of the bona fides of the inability of the person to be fingerprinted, the ASC manager should request that reasonable documentation be submitted by a psychiatrist, a licensed clinical psychologist, or a medical practitioner who has had long-term responsibility for the care of the applicant slash petitioner. Maxwell was astonished at this, so much so, he stated in his testimony before Congress, and I quote, "In my 16 years in law enforcement, I have never heard of someone being exempt from fingerprinting due to a psychiatric condition. Moreover, I cannot fathom circumstances under which an AFC manager would be sufficiently qualified to determine the bona fides of the request for a waiver. At the very least, this policy should affirmatively require proof from a licensed professional rather than just suggesting it if the manager cannot decide for himself. And yet that's exactly what happens, lest we inconvenience the poor immigrant in the slightest." Are you beginning to get upset? Picture this. Alien says, "I can't be fingerprinted because it traumatizes me." Never mind the immigrant is a convicted murderer or terrorist. His emotional well-being is more important than the national security and public safety of the United States. Is this beginning to piss you off yet? But wait, as you can imagine, there's more, because you didn't think I was going to stop here now, did you? We now get into something even more outrageous. We're going to be discussing refugee and asylee travel documents. This is going to make your head spin, and Franz Kafka would have a field day with this. As of late September 2005, Maxwell said, USCIS employees handling applications for refugee asylee travel documents were not comparing the photograph of the applicant for the travel documents with the original photograph submitted by the refugee or asylee and stored in the image storage and retrieval system. Let me repeat that. As of late September 2005, USCIS employees handling applications for refugee asylee travel documents were not comparing the photograph of the applicant for the travel documents with the original photograph submitted by the refugee or asylee and stored in the image storage and retrieval system. Thus, an illegal alien who can obtain biographical information about a legitimate refugee or asylee from a corrupt immigration attorney or USCIS employee, for example, can submit an application for travel documents using the real refugee asylee's name and other biographical information, provide his own photograph, and be issued travel documents with his picture, but the name of the alien with legitimate USCIS records. An alternative scenario is that the actual refugee or asylee could actually sell his or her USCIS information to an illegal, and the illegal can use that information to get their own, very own, refugee or asylee travel document with their picture on it. The illegal alien can then obtain other documents based on a stolen identity established by the travel documents. When USCIS leadership was made aware of this fraud scheme, a domestic operations representative responded by acknowledging that this, quote, is known as a vulnerability, unquote, that they've been looking at for the past year or so. Translation, yeah, we knew about it. So what? We haven't gotten around to doing anything about it for over a year. This same individual clarified for Acting Deputy Director Devine that recent assurances Devine gave to Secretary Chertoff concerning verifying the identity of applicants related to I-90 adjudications, not refugee asylee travel documents. Ironically, in light of the issue in the paragraph below, Acting Deputy Director Devine noted that this issue has particularly poignant reference for USCIS faces a flood of filings by Katrina victims seeking to replace documents. All parties acknowledged implicitly that requiring employees to compare the applicant's photo with the photo of the refugee asylee that is stored in the image storage and retrieval system would end fraud of this type. Did they do anything about it? Nope. This is the very same Acting Deputy Director Robert Devine, who, along with Acting Chief Counsel Dia Carpenter, steadfastly insisted coming to the U.S. as an immigrant is a right, the law to the contrary saying it's a privilege notwithstanding. But wait, the best, or should I say the worst, is yet to come. Buckle up, boys and girls. Next on the hit list, green card replacement. Let me explain the difference in the applications filed for refugee/asylee travel documents versus filing for a replacement green card that was, quote, lost or stolen, unquote. An I-90 is the application for a replacement green card, while an I-131 is an application for a refugee/asylee travel document. They are two entirely different applications, yet Acting Deputy Director Devine got the two confused. Maxwell continues. In mid-December 2005, the ICE Office of Intelligence sent a memo to the USCIS Fraud Detection and National Security Directorate about a fraud scheme that ICE had uncovered that is similar to the one involving refugee and asylee travel documents. This scheme involved the I-90 application for a replacement renewal green card for lawful permanent residents. The same application about which Devine had reassured Secretary Chertoff was perfectly secure. In this scheme, illegal aliens steal the identity or purchase the identity of a lawful permanent resident. Each illegal alien then gets to use the LPR's name and alien registration number to file an I-90 application for a replacement resident card or green card with the illegal alien's photo, fingerprint, and signature on the card. Incredibly, USCIS actually captures the illegal alien's photo, fingerprint, and signature in the image storage and retrieval system, but employees fail to compare any of them with the photo, fingerprint, or signature of the original applicant. ICE identified this as a vulnerability with severe national security implications. You think? Moving right along, the hits just keep on coming. Next is mandatory detention aliens, a policy memo sent to regional and service center directors by the now-retired head of domestic operations, Bill Yates, instructs service centers not to serve a notice to appear, or NTA, which is a document that initiates removal proceedings on aliens who appear to be subject to mandatory detention under Section 236C of the Immigration and Nationality Act, or INA. Instead, employees are instructed to decide on their own the application that has been submitted, prepare and sign an NTA, unless they, on their own again, exercise prosecutorial discretion, more on that in a moment, and decide to allow the convicted criminal to continue living in the United States illegally, and place a memorandum in the file explaining that they are handing the case over to ICE, even though they may not even do so. Just putting the memo in the file and running it to the shelf is sufficient. Section 236C of the Immigration and Nationality Act requires that removable aliens who have been convicted of certain serious crimes, primarily those drug-related crimes or those crimes that have been defined as aggravated felonies in Section 1101A43 of the Immigration and Nationality Act, be detained pending their removal. In other words, they're mandatory detention aliens. Service center employees and senior leadership at headquarters confirm that this memo represents current USCIS policy. Keep in mind, this testimony was in April of 2006. The memo presents two separate issues. First, whether this policy results in aliens who are subject to mandatory detention based on criminal convictions being allowed to remain free in American communities. And second, the applicability and scope of prosecutorial discretion. There is evidence that criminal aliens are being allowed to remain at large in U.S. communities as a result of this policy. Part of the problem is that ICE officials, at least in some parts of the country, apparently have decided that ICE should be paid by USCIS each time it does its job and serves an NTA. A search for a missing alien file that was recently being sought by an agent on the Joint Terrorism Task Force, or JTTF, in the USCIS Philadelphia District Office recently resulted in the discovery of a stash of some 2,500 A-files of aliens whose applications for status and or documents had been denied, but whose cases had not been turned over to ICE to issue NTAs because USCIS personnel at that office decided on their own to hide the files rather than pay ICE to serve all those NTAs. According to the agent who found them, a majority of the files were for aliens from countries of interest. That means that aliens from special interest countries with terrorist ties who do not qualify for legal status for whatever reason are still in the United States illegally, and there has been absolutely no effort to remove them from the country. The memo on prosecutorial discretion, to which the Yates memo refers, was issued by then Immigration and Naturalization Service, or INS, Commissioner Doris Meisner in response, according to the memo, to the Illegal Immigration Reform and Immigrant Responsibility Act of 1996, or IRA. That law included several provisions aimed at getting criminal aliens off the streets and out of the country, including Section 236C of the INA. Meisner asserts that immigration officers may appropriately exercise prosecutorial discretion even when an alien is removable based on his or her criminal history and when the alien, if served with an NTA, would be subject to mandatory detention. However, she reserves prosecutorial discretion to law enforcement entities, which USCIS absolutely refuses to be. As a self-avowed non-law enforcement agency, perhaps USCIS, Maxwell said, would be better off simply obeying the law. I have a better idea. A statutory fix would be to mandate that without exception, any alien whose application for a benefit is denied for whatever the reason, and the alien is unlawfully present in the United States, shall be issued an NTA. And if that alien is subject to the mandatory detention language of Section 236C of the Immigration and Nationality Act, his or her case will be immediately sent to ICE so that ICE can locate, arrest, and detain that alien without a bond. Period. Full stop. No exceptions. So let me ask a question here about prosecutorial discretion, because it seems a little bit incongruous what USCIS is saying. If USCIS is not a law enforcement agency and therefore has no prosecutorial authority, how is it possible they can exercise any prosecutorial discretion if they don't prosecute anyone and don't have the authority to do so? There is nothing for them to exercise discretion over. They shouldn't be allowed to have it both ways, saying, we're not a law enforcement agency, never have been, never will be, but we can decide on who should be arrested and placed in removal or deportation proceedings. I don't think so, Babalu. Pick A or pick B. And with that simple statement, you get the picture. And yet, there's still more. Moving on to national security indicators. As of August 2005, some 1,400 immigration applications, most for U.S. citizenship, that had generated national security hits on IBIS, which is the Interagency Border Information System, were sitting in limbo at USCIS headquarters because the employees trying to process them were unable to obtain the national security information that caused them to be flagged. If a government agency such as the FBI, the CIA, the DEA, the ATF has national security information about an alien, or when an agency has an ongoing investigation that involves an alien, the USCIS employee who runs a name check in text will see only a statement indicating that the particular agency has a national security information interest regarding the alien. This is assuming that the employee has level 3 text access. Without such access, the employee may get no indication at all that national security information even exists. Employees are not permitted to deny an application just because there's a national security information or a record with another law enforcement agency. Instead, the employee must request, acquire, and assess the information to see if it makes the alien statutorily ineligible for the immigration status or document being sought or inadmissible or deportable. However, whether or not an employee can get the national security information in order to assess it depends on at least two things. First, the level of background investigation the employee has undergone, which determines the types of information he or she is lawfully permitted to access, and B, the nature of the national security information, which determines the willingness or ability of the agency with the information to share it with non-law enforcement personnel. All USCIS employees, including those in the Fraud Detection and National Security Directorate, are non-law enforcement personnel. The only ones who are the criminal investigators and some of the security specialists who work in OSI. The more sensitive the national security information, the less likely that the non-law enforcement employee will be able to get it. This is the genesis of the so-called focus cases. Employees see that there is a national security information interest on the alien, but they are unable to obtain the information to assess it. The bulk of focus cases are applications for naturalization because naturalization regulations require USCIS to make a final decision within 120 days of interviewing the applicant. Once that 120-day window closes, the applicant can petition a court for a writ of mandamus, and the court will order USCIS to issue a decision. Now, I'm going to inject what I consider to be a common sense fix to this problem. If an alien applies for U.S. citizenship via an N-400 application for naturalization, and USCIS does all the automated checks through IBIS and text and other databases, and they get a hit, the common sense solution to this 120-day after interviewing the applicant problem is to simply not interview the applicant until they can resolve the hit in either IBIS, text, or whatever other database they access. One would think that would be the smart way to handle it. But then again, USCIS is not in the business of being a law enforcement agency. They're in the business of grinding out applications and approving them. So what happened is USCIS set up a group of employees, the focus group, to review these applications and issue the final decisions. However, as non-law enforcement personnel, they may have no better access to the relevant information than the original employee who sent the application to headquarters in the first place. In fact, some focus employees do not even have access to level 3 text records. OSI, whose law enforcement personnel have the necessary security clearances and the contacts necessary to obtain the pertinent information, offered to assist employees with these applications. However, rather than utilizing OSI, USCIS leadership instructed the focus group members to contact FDNS, the, quote, official USCIS liaison, unquote, with outside law enforcement and intelligence agencies when they need additional information about any of these cases. Since FDNS lacks law enforcement personnel, it too has been unable to obtain the necessary information from these outside agencies in some cases. In documented instances, FDNS has instructed FOCUS employees to grant a benefit even though neither FDNS nor the FOCUS employee knew why the alien generated a national security indicator. Despite the fact that my staff, this is Maxwell testifying, was willing and able to assist in obtaining the national security information that was otherwise unavailable to USCIS, I was ordered directly by Acting Deputy Director Devine to remove myself and my staff from any involvement with the FOCUS cases and to cease any communication with the FBI and the intelligence community. I was told repeatedly that FDNS was the, quote, official liaison, unquote, and so I was to have no further contact with any law enforcement or intelligence agencies or participate in any information sharing either within USCIS or outside USCIS. I have been told that my successor is working under the same constraints. The result is that FOCUS employees are faced with a choice between approving an application for U.S. citizenship with limited information about what raised the national security flag versus denying the application, perhaps wrongly, or asking someone at OSI to violate the direct order of the acting deputy director and the chief of staff in order to share critical information with them. In a November 2005 report on alien security checks by DHS, Office of Inspector General, or OIG, USCIS told the OIG investigators that FDNS has resolved all national security-related IBS or IBIS hits since March of 2005. FDNS's background check analysis unit reviews, tracks, and analyzes and resolves all named vetted hits related to national security. Technically, this statement is true, but only because the former head of domestic operations redefined the word resolution. In a memo dated March 29, 2005, Bill Yates says in a footnote, resolution is accomplished when all available information from the agency that posted the lookout is obtained. A resolution is not always a finite product. Law enforcement agencies may refuse to give details surrounding an investigation. They may also request that an adjudication be placed in abeyance during an ongoing investigation, as there is often a concern that either an approval or a denial may jeopardize the investigation itself. In other words, USCIS employees can, quote, resolve, unquote, a national security hit simply by asking why the alien is flagged, regardless of whether the employee is actually able to obtain the data necessary to decide the application appropriately. One of the first lessons employees are taught in USCIS is that they must grant the benefit unless they can find a statutory reason to deny it. This flies in the face of 60-plus years of American immigration jurisprudence, from Board of Immigration Appeals decisions to U.S. District Court decisions to U.S. Circuit Court decisions to Supreme Court decisions, all of which repeatedly, consistently state coming to this country as an immigrant is a privilege, not a right. Unfortunately, USCIS refused to adhere to the court decisions that are on record. Without the national security information from the law enforcement agency, the employee must grant the benefit unless there is another ground on which to deny it, even where the applicant may present a serious threat to national security. USCIS is operating an immigration system designed not to aggressively deter or detect fraud, but first and foremost to approve applications. Ours is a system, Maxwell said, that rewards criminals and facilitates the movement of terrorists. On no less than 8 occasions in the past year, the DHS Inspector General and the GAO have reported critical systemic failures in the immigration system. They have raised the national security red flag with regard to cyber attack, terrorist attack, criminal fraud, and penetration by foreign intelligence agents posing as temporary workers. All while the bad guys are patiently working within the framework of our legal immigration system, often with the explicit help of USCIS. Currently, the USCIS Headquarters Asylum Division has a backlog of almost 1,000 asylum cases that it has not reported to you as members of Congress, to the Inspector General, or to the American people, Maxwell testified. This backlog includes two kinds of asylum claimants: individuals who claim that they have been falsely accused by their home government of terrorist activity, and individuals who have provided material support to a terrorist or terrorist organization. These asylum claimants, most of whom fall into the second category, are in the United States right now. Some have been awaiting a decision since late 2004 on whether the Secretary of Homeland Security, after consulting with the Secretary of State and the Attorney General, will grant them a waiver of inadmissibility for providing material support to terrorists. Keep in mind, this testimony and all of this information was going on during the Bush administration, the George W. Bush administration, the administration that witnessed the 9/11 attacks on the Twin Towers, the Pentagon, and that field in Shanksville, Pennsylvania. You know, that Bush administration. It is no wonder DHS does not want to report this backlog. But wait, as you can imagine, there's even more. The USCIS Headquarters Fraud Detection and National Security Directorate also has an unreported backlog. As of September 24th, 2005, this backlog included 13,815 immigration applications that had resulted in an IBIS hit involving national security, public safety, wants and warrants, Interpol interest, or absconders. FDNS had a separate backlog of 26,000 immigration applications that resulted in some other kind of IBIS hit. In late March of 2005, FDNS began requiring that all national security-related IBIS hits be sent to headquarters for resolution. During the 6 months between April of 2005 and the end of September 2005, FDNS headquarters received 2,000 national security hits and reached final resolution on 650 of them, leaving 1,350 pending by the beginning of October. This backlog of national security cases is particularly disturbing when put in the context of USCIS's definition of how to, quote, resolve, unquote, a national security case. One has to wonder how many of them were resolved simply by asking for the national security information and then granting the application when the agency with the information refused to share it. We have proof of at least one case, Maxwell said, where that would have happened had OSI not stepped in and provided the national security information. The USCIS's general counsel's office points out another such case, except that they expect to grant the application for citizenship despite the national security hit because the national security information is unavailable to USCIS at this time. Perhaps the following finding from the General Accountability, Government Accountability Office sheds light on the truth. Verifying an applicant submitted evidence in pursuit of its fraud prevention objectives represents a resource commitment for USCIS and a potential trade-off with its production and customer service-related objectives. In fiscal year 2004, USCIS had a backlog of several million applications and has developed a plan to eliminate it by the end of fiscal year 2006. In June 2004, USCIS reported that it would have to increase monthly production by about 20% to achieve its legislatively mandated goal of adjudicating all applications within 6 months or less by the end of fiscal year 2006. It would be literally impossible for USCIS to verify all of the key information or interview all individuals related to the millions of applications it adjudicates each year, approximately 7.5 million applications in fiscal year 2005 alone, without seriously compromising its service-related objectives. USCIS leadership has been warned repeatedly, Maxwell said, of national security vulnerabilities in the asylum, refugee, citizenship, information technology, and green card renewal systems by me personally, by the GAO, by the Inspector General, and no doubt by others. Time and again, they have ignored warnings of systemic weaknesses wide open to exploitation by criminal, terrorists, and foreign intelligence agents. When faced with irrefutable proof of vulnerabilities, they attempted to balance national security and customer service and explained to me that immigration was a right, not a privilege, Maxwell testified to. They have knowingly misled Congress, the Inspector General's office, the GAO, and perhaps most disheartening, the American people. They are attempting to simply reboot the immigration system in the hope that whatever system conflict there is will just resolve itself and go away. In this case, however, if you just reinstall the same software with the same software engineers and without the necessary safeguards in place to catch viruses or deter hackers, the system simply replicates itself and bogs down all over again until one day there is a catastrophic failure. This root conflict is not going to go away without immediate and enormous change. The immigration process itself is flawed and is being exploited internally and externally by criminals, terrorists, and foreign intelligence agencies. Maxwell wraps up his testimony in an emotional and poignant way. He stated, and I quote, "In closing, Mr. Chairman, I sit before this committee having lost my career, my passion for service to the government, my faith that someone, somewhere, would do the right thing within DHS. I know there are more good men and women in the agency who would like nothing more than to do their part in fixing this broken system. I have now been able to present some of the information I have gathered to the FBI, the GAO, the Inspector General, and to you. Thankfully, senior leadership can no longer retaliate against me, for I am no longer employed by DHS. Based on the response I have seen thus far, I am hopeful that enough people will come forward that with your help, we will finally be able to force serious change on an agency that has needed it desperately for decades. Maxwell was played by USCIS upper management and lied to. He was given the impression operational and program integrity were a primary concern within USCIS. Unfortunately, as he found out, that was merely smoke and mirrors. Every time he tried to do his job, the job he was ostensibly hired to do, he was stymied and prevented from doing it at the expense of American people, the national security and public interest and public safety of the United States of America. The open border cabal within USCIS ground him down to the point he had no other alternative but to resign. From Devine to Carpenter to Dawkins, Spassato, Parr, Crescetti, and others, they threw Maxwell under the bus, ran over him, backed the bus up over him, and ran over him a second time. They knowingly, intentionally, deliberately, willfully, and maliciously sacrificed the national security and public safety interests of the United States rather than offend the likes of George Soros, the Clintons, the Bushes, the Obamas, Tim Steyer, Bill Gates, and the rest of the global elite who believe in that, quote, New World Order George H.W. Bush mentioned in a speech so long ago. And now, we have Biden, Harris, Pelosi, Schumer, Romney, Murkowski, and the rest of the Democratic Socialists and New World Order Republicans who have taken a really bad situation and made it much worse. They can't even call what's happening at our southern border now the crisis it is, the crisis everyone sees it as. Perhaps the proper term to use is invasion. So to put it in the context of marriage fraud and the failure of USCIS to protect and serve American citizens in favor of assisting foreign nationals, you should be beginning to understand why things are the way they are and why reported marriage fraud scams, VAWA fraud, U-Visa fraud, and T-Visa fraud fall on deaf ears. Put simply, USCIS upper management doesn't give a rat's ass. The damage being inflicted upon U.S. citizens notwithstanding. And if this hasn't been enough, next week, we'll pick up with Maxwell's testimony in July of 2006. Now, we ran long today. We're at about 49 minutes. But I wanted to make sure we got it all in. So please feel free to comment on the Facebook page Until Green Card Do Us Part, or email me at csiinvestigations@neteason, that's netecin.net. Until next week, I'm your host, John Sampson. Thanks for listening.